Welcome, everybody, to episode 2 of It's Lit Time with Dr. Tess. I promised an episode in June, and I hope you'll forgive me. It's July 1st, but very close. I was very close. I'm excited about my schedule for July. I have several guests that are going to be coming on with me and talking about a variety of topics. But today we're going to do another kind of foundational episode similar to the one I gave you, I guess, way back in May now, which was on what is a story. And you can certainly enjoy this one without having listened to the first one, but I'm hoping to maybe refer back to some of the things that I talked about in What is a Story. So if you are interested, you might want to go back to that one. Today we're going to talk about what is a novel. There's actually a more specific question that was asked to me by my father, Todd Stockslager, who I think I'm going to shout out on every episode because I already have on the first one. I'll return to that more specific question that he asked me a little bit later in the episode. But I'm going to start in keeping with our theme, our Forky theme. You know, Forky from Toy Story 4. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to episode 1. Or just go on Disney Plus or YouTube and look up the Forky Asks a Question series. So our first episode was What is a Story? Today I'm going to talk about what is a novel. So I'm going to talk about the definition of the word novel. I'm going to give you what I hope will be a very brief history of the novel, but I get a little bit excited about the history of the novel because it overlaps with and indeed is almost identical to the history of modern British literature, which is, and I'm defining modern really broadly, which is my area of interest. So I'm going to try not to get too geeked out about it and keep it short. Then we're going to talk about what is a novel good for? What is it good at doing that perhaps other types of literature are not as good at doing? And then finally, we're going to talk, and I hope that in this section, I will be addressing the question that my dad initially asked, what does it take to read a novel? What do you need to have in your reader tool belt in order to enjoy a novel? So let's start with what is a novel. I wasn't going to do a really basic definition, but then I started noticing that even some of my students who are really smart and capable and pretty well-read people were using this word incorrectly. So this first part of the episode is just a little bit of a public service announcement, and that is this. A novel is a book-length work of fiction. Fiction is the key word that I think a lot of people forget or don't know about this definition. And it doesn't help that a lot of times we'll say things jokingly, like, you know, if you see somebody writing a really long text message, you might say, what are you writing, a novel? So we tend to just focus on the book length part or like the really long text part. But we forget that a novel also needs to be a work of fiction. So like your really long psychology textbook is not a novel, hopefully. It is a work of nonfiction. And I know a lot of people get fiction and nonfiction mixed up, so it might help for you to think about the fact that fiction and fact are opposites, okay? So a work of nonfiction is going to be true, hopefully. I'm not going to get into all the nuances of that right now. And a work of fiction is going to be a made-up story. That doesn't mean that it can't, you know, ring true to your life experience, that it can't, you know, teach you something about the real world, but it is a made-up story, okay? So first of all, a novel is a book-length work of fiction. Now, I want to talk about a tiny bit about the history of the novel, because today novels are a really common type of book and a really common storytelling mechanism in our culture. If you're in a book club, unless you're in a book club that reads nonfiction, which I know there are some of those too, you're probably reading novels in your book club. You're probably not reading like epic poetry. You're probably not reading, you might be occasionally reading short story collections, and I'm going to talk about short stories later on in this episode, but you're probably not reading plays in your book club. If you're reading fiction, you're probably reading novels, and that's, I think, a significant point, because it means two things. One is that the novel is, I would argue, the most prevalent text-based storytelling mechanism in our culture. Now, I think that movies are much more widespread and popular and maybe have more cultural power than novels do in our moment in time. But I'm talking today about text-based forms of storytelling. So movies, are not in print. I mean, I guess if you're a huge fan of a movie, you might like own the script to it, but most people are not reading movie scripts for fun. Okay. All right. So we'll talk about movies in lots of other episodes, but today we're going to talk about novels. And so I think that's because it's so prevalent in our culture, it leads us to the second thing, which is that novels are almost like kind of like the atmosphere that we live in or the air that we breathe in. And so a lot of times we don't think about what is a novel. Okay. It's almost become just like a word that people put on the front of their books to make it look like fancy and literary, like, you know, blah, 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 a novel by Tess Martinez or whatever. So, let's talk about what it is. So the novel hasn't always been around. And I want to go and guys, I'm going to say this again for those of you who are English majors or English teachers who are doing me the honor of listening to this. I am going to be speeding through this history, maybe making some generalizations. If I say something that's outright not true that you want to challenge me on, or even something that's like a little bit not true that you want to challenge me on, that's fine. But please keep in mind that I'm making generalizations in the interest of time and not overwhelming people. Okay. So once upon a time, the novel didn't exist. And if you think of earlier cultures and their forms of storytelling, I mean, we could go back to, you know, oral cultures where stories were mostly told around a fire by a bard, and so they were listened to rather than read. And there still are cultures like that in our world today. Then we can think of cultures that, and actually a lot of these were one and the same, cultures where epic poetry was the main vehicle for storytelling. And so you think of your famous epic poems like the Greek epics, you know, you think of poems like Beowulf and things like that. And then we've also had times in the history of civilization where I would say that theater has been one of the most dominant forms of storytelling, both going to see plays and reading plays. Of course, we still have this in our culture, but I don't think what I'm about to say is a controversial statement, but it might be. I don't think that theater has quite the cultural pull or cultural influence in our day, at least in America, than it did like in, say, like the Renaissance period or something like that. So we still have theater in our culture. It's still influential. I'm not trying to say that, but it's not like I wouldn't say it's our dominant means of storytelling. Okay. I'm re starting to repeat myself here. I gotta rein myself in. All right. So many historians and literary critics would say that what made the novel possible was all that stuff that happened at the beginning of what we call the modern period. So the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, which are all overlapping movements that happened at the end of what we call the Middle Ages or the medieval period, and brought us into the period that I would say in a lot of ways we're still living in today, even though a lot of people would say we've moved on to the postmodern period. I'm not getting into that today. I'm not a philosopher. Let me just give you a really, really basic example of what I'm talking about here. Have you ever seen the movie A Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger, the late, great Heath Ledger, whom we miss? One of the big questions in that movie that the main character, William, keeps asking is, can a man change his stars? Meaning, can a man change his destiny or his fate? And that's actually a really, really modern question, even though that story is set in medieval times. In fact, people, not only would that have been a really revolutionary question to ask back then, I don't even think people would have, most people would have been asking it at all because they wouldn't have had the vocabulary or the conceptual framework to being able to be able to ask it, because the prevalent idea, at least in Europe, and I realize I'm presenting a really Eurocentric view of things here in this episode, but again, that's my area that I know. People would just say, like, okay, I was born this way. I was born into the great chain of being. I was born a peasant. You know, I was born to be a blacksmith because that's what my father is, you know, whatever. And no, I don't really have a whole lot of autonomy over what I'm going to do with my life, except maybe I can make choices like, you know, treating other people well and stuff like that. But I can't change my fate or my stars. I can't become a knight or whatever, you know. And by the way, that's not a criticism of A Knight's Tale when I say that they're asking a modern question in a medieval movie. That movie is not, in my opinion, that story, they're using medieval kind of trappings and costumes in order to tell a really modern story. And I think the fact that they use a lot of really like groovy 20th century rock and roll music in that movie kind of is a hint that like, hey, this isn't really a medieval story. P.S. by the way. That's my example there. So a lot of historians and literary critics would say that you need to have the modern sensibility in order to have the novel. This idea that actually, yes, I do have more agency over who I am. My identity is somewhat up to me. My identity even matters. Like, I don't, again, I'm overgeneralizing, but I don't think people in the Middle Ages thought a whole lot about like, who am I and what is my purpose in the world? And these questions that we think about today, they were kind of just like, I'm going to do my job and keep my head down and not get in trouble. Novels are well suited to explore character development and character change and questions of identity. And so if you look at a, like, say, an ancient epic poem or even a medieval or like an early medieval epic poem like Beowulf, there's not a whole lot of people sitting around going like, who am I and what is my purpose in life? And not a whole lot of questions of identity and introspection. It's mostly just like doing stuff, you know, brave deeds. And a lot of times people's motivation for doing stuff is because, well, the gods made me do it, you know, again, overgeneralizing. With the coming of the Enlightenment, Renaissance, Reformation, the coming of the modern period, we started to ask those kinds of questions. And so we started writing books, novels, that would explore that kind of thing. Like, who is this character and who are they becoming? One thing that a novel, and I'm going to get to this section later, but just to give you a little preview, one thing that a novel does really well is it shows character change over a period of time, much better than I think any form of literature or any form of storytelling, except maybe like a long movie, or maybe a movie series. That's the early history of the novel. Just as kind of like an interesting sidebar here, a lot of people would say that some of the first novels, you know what, I'm not going to go into this in this episode. I think this needs to be a different episode, the history of the novel, because I could go on for quite a while about that. So I'm gonna put a pin in that, and we'll come back and talk about what some of the first novels were, and then we'll probably spend a long time talking about the Victorian period, because that's my favorite. We'll do that in another episode, maybe a Charles Dickens episode. We'll kind of like set the scene for Charles Dickens. Okay, so novels, they really exploded. I'll just summarize it to this. They started in, like I said, really the 18th century, which, by the way, don't forget, when we say the 18th century, we're talking about the 1700s. I know that that's very confusing. When we say the 19th century, we're talking about the 1800s, etc. So they really, most people would say the novel, especially at least in English, and I think this is mainly true in other languages as well, started in the 18th century and really, really exploded in the 19th century. And so you have these massive multi-volume novels coming out in the 19th century. I said I wasn't going to go over this, and I'm doing it anyway. I'm not mentioning names. Even though there was a reaction against those massive novels in the early part of the 20th century, and so you have like modernist writers who were experimenting with different forms like stream of consciousness, going back to poetry as a more dominant art form. They were writing shorter novels. They were writing novels that kind of like broke tradition with, you know, telling in chronological order. They were trying all sorts of experimental stuff, basically. Even though they were reacting against those massive Victorian novels, the novel never went away. And novels, like I say, still have a lot of cultural power today. There are thousands, probably maybe millions of novels coming out every year, especially now that self-publishing is so easy to do. Novels are just everywhere. I wanted to talk about that just to make us kind of aware of the fact that, you know, novels haven't always been around. And by the way, I want to give one more example of you know, what this actually means practically. If you're a person who reads the Bible, have you ever been reading the Bible and wondered like, well, what was Jesus' facial expression when he said this? Or, you know, what was Abraham thinking when he did this or whatever? Because the Bible is not modern because it was written in a much earlier time period. Normally, their authors are focusing more on what was done. Now, yes, they're focusing also on what God did, not on just what people did, but there's a lot more emphasis on just like tell a story quickly, you know, and don't get bogged down in like, you know, character development, right? And so I do think, and maybe this was is a topic for another episode, I do think there are parts of the Bible, like such as Paul's letters or even something older like the Book of Job, that are really like almost eerily modern. Like they really, really speak to us today and don't seem as old, in my opinion. And maybe sometime I'll have like a Bible scholar on here so we can talk about why that is. I have some thoughts. But anyway, most of the time you're not going to get like that, you know, and, you know, they're not going to give you a 2-page description of how beautiful the shores of the Sea of Galilee looked when Jesus sat down to teach the Sermon on the Mount. That's just not, those are things that we associate with novels, not with the kind of storytelling that was done in the Bible. And by the way, I believe the Bible is true. I'm not saying that this is fictional storytelling, but it is a form of, it's a narrative, it's a form of storytelling. So anyway, that's sidebar. Okay, nowadays, if the Bible were being written in our time period, there probably would be a lot more like stuff about people's tone of voice and their facial expression and the setting and all that kind of stuff, in my opinion. Bible would probably be even longer if it was written today. So anyway, okay, let's go back to novels. So novels, what have we learned so far? It's a book-length work of fiction. It is a uniquely modern art form or literary form that did not exist before about the 1700s. And let me say one more thing that I think is interesting about novels, just from a historical perspective. There was a time when people thought, and by the way, the word novel, you've probably realized this, can also be used as an adjective. And in that, when it's used as an adjective, it means new or like, you're fresh, or, oh, that's a novel idea. Like that's a new idea. I've never thought of that before. And so that's actually where our English word novel came from, because it was a new, like I said, it was a new form. And it, for a while, it was kind of looked at with mistrust. I mean, there was a time that lasted into the 19th century where a lot of people who were, I don't know, preachers, teachers, cultural critics, or people who thought of themselves as cultural critics, actually thought novels were dangerous, especially for young women, because they thought either on one extreme that they were going to lead young women or young people in general into bad morals by providing bad examples, or they might have just said, you know, these are silly. Young people should not be wasting their time on novels. They should be focusing on, you know, truth and improving their own character and that kind of stuff. Now, I actually believe that reading novels, if we do it well, can help us improve our own character. And I'll get to that in a second, but I wanted to make that historical point. So there was a time when some people thought novel reading was dangerous for young minds, which I think is kind of funny. All right, so we talked about the definition of novel. We talked about the history of a novel. Now I want to talk about two things that a novel is really good at doing. One of them I mentioned before, but I'm going to save that one for a second. The first one is a novel is good at having tons of characters. This is one reason why I enjoy reading novels. Right now I'm listening to a BBC radio drama adaptation of Charles Dickens' novel, Our Mutual Friend. And it's been a little while since I read the book, and listening to this, I was just thinking about this morning, it's kind of blowing my mind how many characters there are in a typical Charles Dickens novel. I mean, just multiple plot lines, and they all usually come together at some point, but there are just so many people. And I was just thinking, like, man, they had to cast a ton of actors for this thing. Or maybe there's people playing multiple roles, I don't know. But that's one thing that a novel is really good at, as opposed to, say, a short story, which might only have a few characters in it. A novel is good at having multiple plot lines, which I think helps it seem a little bit more like real life, which is a point I'm going to make in a little bit here. Okay, let me pause and talk about short stories, because one thing I want to do over the next couple of minutes is compare and contrast novels and short stories. And like I said, short stories are not that popular in our culture. A lot of times the only people The only time a lot of people will encounter short stories is maybe in required reading in high school and or like freshman year of college. And so it's not that common for people to be reading short stories like for fun in our culture, with a few exceptions. For example, if you subscribe to the magazine The New Yorker, they always publish a short story in there. And maybe there's some other magazines that do that too, but that's one I happen to know about because I used to subscribe to it. And there were some good short stories published in there. And then every once in a while, an author, a well-known author, usually who is also a novelist, will come out with like a collection of short stories. One author who is pretty popular in our culture and considered, you know, a major influence, who I think got started out writing short stories. I may have the chronology backwards on this, but it's George Saunders. George Saunders is best known for writing the novel Lincoln in the Bardo, which I don't know anything about, so don't ask me. I haven't read it. But I have read his short story collection, 10th of December, which was really, really good. Just a wide variety. Some of his short stories are a little on the long side. But they're definitely too short to be called novels. And so they're all collected in this one book, which I do highly recommend. I really enjoyed. There was a lot of humor, but a lot of just feeling. And there's a lot you can learn, I think, from that short story collection. So again, it's called 10th of December by George Saunders. Anyway, so yeah, I'm not saying that nobody's writing short stories, but I'm saying I don't think enough people are writing short stories, especially in comparison to how many people are writing novels. And there are definitely things that you can do with a short story that are hard to do with a novel. A short story can pack a huge emotional punch because it is so short. Short stories are also really good places for twist endings that aren't like gimmicky, like really good twist endings that like just hit you in the gut. Short stories are good for a character having a revelation. In fact, one of our greatest American short story writers, who I mean is no longer living, she died many decades ago, but is Flannery O'Connor. Maybe you probably had to read Flannery O'Connor's story, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, maybe in school. By the way, it's not about dating, it's about murder. So go back and read A Good Man Is Hard to Find. But anyway, she's a very good short story writer. Often her stories have twist endings or just moments where a character has a revelation. And in fact, she actually has a short story called Revelation that's a really good example of that. Flannery O'Connor, great writer. Maybe I'll do another episode on her. Even though I have a hard time having warm feelings toward her because her stuff is just so weird and her characters are usually not very likable. But I think she's brilliant. So anyway, so yeah, short stories are good for that kind of stuff. I'm a fan of short stories. Again, like I said, more people should be writing them. I wrote 3 short stories in grad school that I was very proud of, and I've never written one since then, but that's that. Okay, so I'm going to be kind of contrasting short stories and novels over the next couple minutes here. So I wanted to do a little sidebar for short stories. Some of them are kind of long, but when they start getting past a certain point, they become more of a novella. So a novella would be between a short story and a novel. There's not really hard and fast rules on this. Think of like Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. That I would consider a novella. It has chapters in it, but they're short. Okay. Well, where was I going with all this? Okay, I said 2 things that a novel is really good at doing. One of them is having tons of characters. Okay, second thing, I've already mentioned this, is showing character development over a period of time. Not sudden change, but gradual development. Like what happens in real life, you know? We usually don't just have a moment where we suddenly change everything. I mean, it's possible for that to happen. And there are certainly moments of realization where we realize that we need to change everything. And again, I think those would be well captured in a short story. But most of the time, change takes time. And novels are really good at showing that. Because they do usually, I mean, again, there are no rules on this. You could have a novel that took place over the space of like a week. And there are some novels out there like that. But a lot of times it takes place over years. They show people changing. Now, that could be changing for the better. And in fact, there's a type of novel that I'm going to throw a big German word at you here. It's called Bildungsroman, which basically means like a novel of development or building. And a lot of times those novels will start when the main character is a child and it will go all the way up to their adulthood. And so they maybe go from rags to riches, or maybe they just become a better person. But you could also have a novel where somebody's getting worse. And I think, to borrow a term from drama here, I think we would call that kind of novel a tragedy. A tragedy is usually associated more with plays, you know, like Shakespeare's tragedies, but like Macbeth and stuff. But that could also happen in a novel. In fact, I'm going to have a guest on here later on this month. He and I are going to talk about The Godfather by Mario Puzo. And I would call that a tragedy. And I think the movie in particular really captures that, like the fall of Michael Corleone. And so we'll talk about that. But yes, you could have somebody getting worse, you could have somebody getting better, but rarely do you have a main character in a novel who doesn't change at all. I guess they could change and then go back to where they were back at the beginning. That sometimes happens. And remember that book that I talked about in episode one, A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and I said it breaks a lot of the rules of a typical story. I would almost call that one number one. I think I would call it a novella because it's pretty short. But two, he doesn't really change at all because it takes place over the space of one day. And so that one's different, but I'm just bringing that up to say that there are exceptions. Anyways, okay, so it's good. Novel is good at showing gradual character change. Last thing I want to talk about, and I'm gonna try to just keep this to no more than 5 minutes, is what does it take to read a novel? And I think, Dad, if you want to chime in on this, I think this is the question that you were getting at. There's two main things that I think it takes to read a novel. One of them is commitment. Like, I mean, not all novels are, you know, the what someone called loose baggy monsters of the Victorian period, where they would go like where like 600 pages was a short novel. Not all of them are that long these days. In fact, I would say 300 to 400 is the more average number, and they can be even shorter than that. But it still it takes commitment to stick with a novel, not just because it tends to be long, but because it does kind of take you on an emotional roller coaster as you watch this other person's character development. The other thing that a novel requires of us as readers is what I think it was Samuel Taylor Coleridge, it was one of those English romantic people, correct me if I'm wrong, called the willing suspension of disbelief. This idea that you know that what you're reading is fictional, but you're going to put aside that knowledge and allow yourself to believe that it's true. Not like in a psychotic kind of way, like where you start like talking to the characters, but like, I mean, if you want to talk to characters in a novel, that's fine. I'm not going to judge you. I've done it before. But not where you like actually believe that they're true, but like you, during the duration of the time that you're reading it, you think of them as real people and this as a real situation. And going back to that idea of people thinking that novels were dangerous for young people, that's where some of that idea came from. In fact, a lot of like the Puritans, for example, would say, you know, you shouldn't go see plays and you shouldn't read novels because they're a form of lying, because, you know, like the actors in the plays are pretending to be somebody they're not. I think that's a really, really simplistic idea, and I think you and I understand that, but there was a time when not everybody saw it that way. You have to willingly suspend your disbelief. And so one other thing, let me give you like a bonus third thing that novels are really good at, based on these two things that I've just said. Novels are really good at making us feel like we are part of the story. And I would say the same thing is true for any kind of long form storytelling, like a TV series or a long movie or a movie trilogy or whatever. They're really good at making us feel like we are, those people are part of our lives. And there's been a lot of research done on this, and I get into it in my doctoral dissertation because I wrote a little bit about serial fiction, not like Cheerios, but like, you know, in a series, fiction in my doctoral dissertation, although Cheerios fiction sounds fun too. Excuse me. I cracked myself up there. Have you ever had this experience? I'm going to give you an example. Like when I was watching the show Downton Abbey, I really started feeling like those people were my family, because they not only was I, and by the way, I didn't sit down and binge Downton Abbey. I watched it over a period of time. And so I really started feeling like those people were part of my day-to-day life. And so when one major character, whose name I won't name right now, died, I was really upset. Like I cried, because that person had started to feel like family to me. Let me give you one other funny example. Back when the show ER was on, I'm gonna embarrass my sister for a second here. My sister Sarah was a big ER fan, and there was one time we went to a Christian school, and so sometimes the teachers would start class with prayer requests, and Sarah I don't remember if she actually said it or if she stopped herself before she said it, but she almost gave a prayer request for a character on ER because their story felt so real to her and was so much a part of her life. So that's another thing that novels are good at, especially if you don't sit down and read it all in one night. I've never been able to do that, especially if it becomes part of your life for a week or a month, if you're reading like a Stephen King novel, maybe 5 months because they're so long, however long it takes you to read the novel. It becomes a part of your life. And so that's why one reason why I love novels. They really do become part of the rhythm of your life. I am right about at half hour here, so I'm going to stop. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. It means a lot to me. I would love to hear your feedback about future episodes you'd be interested in. Although I am all scheduled out for the month of July, with my guests, whom I'm really excited about. So I hope you will tune back in, for soon coming episodes. And once again, lit time never really ends, but I'm going to end this episode of It's Lit Time with Dr. Tess.